Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, guys, welcome to Conspiranormal. It's Adam. I'm here by my lonesome tonight, but I have a great guest with us tonight, and that is Drew Hurst Beeson, who has written extensively about the Yuba County 5 case and the Zodiac Killer. But and I want to maybe talk a little bit about the Zodiac Killer stuff, you know, later on. Sure. But tonight, what we're going to talk about is the D.B. Cooper case. And this is one of those that has really, like, fascinated me over the years. Of course, I'm kind of like, I'm a child of the, like, unsolved mysteries, age era. And I can remember seeing that on Unsolved Mysteries back in the day. And, you know, it's one of those cases that, like, he was whoever did it was very, very ballsy to do what they did and pull it off. And we'll kind of go over the specifics of the case for people that don't know. But I think, Drew, what I'd like to start with is how you personally became interested in the D.B. Cooper case. And we can kind of talk about for people that don't know, about what D.B. Cooper did.
Sure, Adam. You know, just like you, I got into it through Unsolved Mysteries, that one episode where they covered it, because that was, you know, one of my favorite shows at the time. Of course, the great Robert Stack. That was the best thing going on TV, probably still my all-time favorite TV show. And when I watched that, I was just enthralled with it. And not long after that episode, I think I'd seen a rerun on In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, who covered D.B. Cooper. And that one came out in 79, but I think I watched that after I had seen the Unsolved Mysteries episode, which came in I think the late 80s. So that's the same thing that happened to me. I saw it and was just like, man, this is cool. You know, this guy's wearing this suit with a black tie. He's got the shades on. He's got that whole, you know, him against the man kind of deal going, and he got away with it. That was what was so cool about it. You know, he didn't kill anybody, rattled some people a little bit, but no one got killed, and they never found him. I mean, it was just the unsolved aspect that just totally sucked me into this case. And then it kind of got renewed some years later when a researcher named Galen Cook started coming on Coast to Coast AM, of course, I'm sure you know well. And he started talking about a suspect named William Gossett, who went by later changed the name to Wolfgang Gossett. And Galen was real articulate. He's an attorney up in the Seattle area. And that kind of rekindled my interest in the case, hearing him, you know, his research on a guy named William Gossett. So that's kind of, you know, just led me to digging in more and kind of like being a lurker on some of the message boards, and then becoming sucked into what they now call the vortex. And that's a phrase coined by a guy named Mark Metzler, who is a real avid skydiver. And then, of course, the All D.B. Cooper podcast by a good friend of mine named Darren Schaefer wound up naming his podcast that, the Cooper Vortex, based on that name. And the podcast became really popular. I was the first person that reached out to Darren asking to be on that show. So that when that happened to him, he said he knew he had something, because everybody else he had to go hunt down to be guest on that show. But I was the first guy that emailed him and said, hey, I want to come on and talk about D.B. Cooper. He said, sure, let's book it. So that's kind of how it went.
Yeah, it amazes me for something that it was a one-time thing that happened. And it amazes me how much the story of D.B. Cooper resonates with a lot of people. And like you just said, like there's this podcast, there's all these books. You know, Surfiel, my co-host, who's not with us this evening, lives up in Seattle, and he told me just recently there was the Cooper Con up there. Cooper so Con, there's like conventions devoted to this. And I saw when I was watching some of your YouTube channel, there was a picture, and I guess it was the Cooper Con maybe, but like people were dressed up like DB Cooper.
Oh yeah, they dress up. Yeah,
it's very cool and it's interesting. Yeah. And it's like there's also this thing with DB Cooper, kind of like my own observation is that like he very much looks like kind of like that classic kind of Man in Black.
Yeah,
that you see
exactly,
in the
you know,
world too. So there's like this
Reservoir
this,
Dogs or something like that.
Yeah,
or Mad,
yeah.
Show Mad Men, you know, he's just coined that look. I think that's where they all kind of got inspired from that.
Right. Look. I mean, I never watched Mad Men, but wasn't there some like, I remember people started talking about that Mad Men was going to go that way where the main character was DB Cooper.
Don Draper. Like I've never watched much of it, but I think the character was Don Draper, who kind of gets in there as a suspect.
yeah. And I think like it was supposed to end that way or something like that. I've never watched that show, but for people like I said, for people that don't know the specifics of the case of DB Cooper, can you recount that, what happened?
Yeah, this all started out. It was Thanksgiving Eve, November 24th of 1971. A man is walking through the Portland International Airport. He's carrying an anti-shake case. He's wearing a sport coat. He's got a black tie on, and he walks up to the ticket counter and he buys a one-way ticket to Seattle for $20 cash. He boards the plane. He takes one of the seats in the back row, and a very unassuming looking guy. Looks just like a regular businessman traveling somewhere. And, as soon as the plane takes off, heading for this just a short milk run going from Portland to Seattle, just heading due north. I think that's, you know, normally like maybe an hour flight, you know, a little milk run. And as soon as the plane kind of levels off after takeoff, one of the stewardesses comes back there. Her name was Florence Schaffner. And he gets her attention and he hands her a note. And she thinks he's flirting with her. And she just said, like many businessmen do, because she was attractive in her 20s, and she just kind of put it in her pocket. And he said, "No, miss, I need you to read that note," and kind of tugs on her arm, and she reads the note. It says, "I have a bomb and I need you to sit by me." And that got her attention. So she winds up sitting next to this man. He bought the ticket, by the way, under the name Dan Cooper. That's mm-hmm. who the ticket agent, that's the name he gave to the ticket agent. It was Northwest Orient Flight 305. And he's on the plane with her, and now he's got her attention. He opens up his anti-shake case, and it looks like a bomb. And that's what it's supposed to look like. To this day, we don't know if it was real or not, but it looked real enough to her. And he says, "I need you to take down some notes for me." And then he began to make his demands. He wanted four parachutes. He said two front and two back, which would be two complete sets, two back parachutes and two what they would call a belly reserve. And he said, "I want $200,000 in cash." Some people believe he said in negotiable American currency. I don't know myself if I believe that, but that's one of the things that he said in his demands that she's writing down. And then he's going to want the plane to be refueled when they get to Seattle. So she takes these notes up to the cockpit and tells them what happened. "Hey, this guy's hijacking the plane. Here's his demands. He's got a bomb. It looked real to me." So the people in the cockpit immediately got in contact with Northwest Orient, and they said, "Definitely, you know, we're going to meet his demands. We're not going to play games with this guy." And this was a game changer. No, people had hijacked airplanes before, but never with a bomb in a briefcase. This is something that has not been encountered before. So, the flight, it takes them a while. They're going to try to they're trying to round up this $200,000 in cash at one of the banks in Seattle, and they're trying to catalog some of the serial numbers on this money. They have two different groups basically working to try to find these parachutes, and they wind up getting four parachutes taken by taxi cab over to the SeaTac airport. So what they're basically doing is the plane is circling around SeaTac because he's waiting for them to collect all this stuff. So they just keep telling the passengers had no idea the plane was being hijacked. Yeah. Only the flight crew. Nobody on board knew anything was wrong whatsoever. So after about a 2.5 hour delay or so, they were told that everything is at the airport. So he tells them they can go ahead and land the plane far away from the terminal because he's worried about snipers and things like that. They bring the money on to him. They brought it in a bank bag instead of a knapsack that he asked for. So he's a little perturbed by that. They bring him his four parachutes. They're there on board. And so he winds up letting all the passengers go because now they've met his demands. But he wants the whole flight crew to stay, which were two pilots, a first officer, and three stewardesses, which they used to just call stews back in the day. So they're all going to remain on board now that he has everything that he's asked for. An interesting thing is what he wanted to do is to have the plane take off from Seattle, now that his demands were met, with the aft staircase down. And that's a staircase in the belly of the back of the plane. This was a Boeing 727. It had that unique feature of that back staircase in the belly of the plane. And Cooper told them that he wanted the plane to take off with that stair down. And the pilots did not know that could be done, that the plane could actually take off with that stair down. And they said, we're not doing it. You know, this is going to cause damage to the aircraft. And Cooper relented. And he said, okay, that's fine. Go ahead and take off with the staircase up. So the plane takes off, ramps them on board, complete flight crew on board. And somewhere near just north of Portland, Oregon, after they've been in the plane for a while, he jumps out of that aft stair. He has one of the stewardesses, her name was Tina Mucklow, that spent the most time with DB Cooper. He had her help him lower the aft staircase in mid-flight, and then he told her to go back up to the cockpit after he donned one of the parachutes. And he, you know, she recalled him putting it on like he knew what he was doing. He still didn't have the money secured, so he cut one of the other parachutes up with a pocket knife, and he wound up strapping it to his body. This bank bag, he wound up just tying the shroud lines from another parachute to his body, kind of MacGyver-like is what Brian Burns likes to use, my friend, when describing it. And somewhere over where they think maybe was, you know, first thought to be Ariel, Washington, and then possibly also Battleground, Washington, somewhere north of Portland, Oregon, they felt a pressure bump in the plane. And that's where they believe DB Cooper leapt out of that aft stair, and he was never found, never seen again, until $5,800 of the $200,000 ransom was found by a young boy named Brian Ingram. He was 8 years old at the time, at a place called the Tina Bar, like a little beach area just off of the Columbia River. He was having a barbecue with his family, a little picnic, and he was digging up some firewood. It was cold, and wound up finding $5,800 of DB Cooper's deteriorated money. And they got the FBI involved. They were able to verify with the serial numbers that this was part of DB Cooper's loot. And till this day, not another $20 bill. They were all 20s that he asked for. And they have still not found one other single bill from the hijacking other than the roughly $5,800 Brian Ingram found in 1980. So that's kind of a case in of itself, is how the money got buried at the Tina Bar. So in DB Cooper world, as we call it, there's two mysteries. One, who DB Cooper was, and right, number two, how did the money wind up at the Tina Bar, is still hotly debated among us Cooperites, as we're called, till this day.
So the money, was it along the line of where they believe that he jumped out of the airplane?
No, it was not. Yeah. There's several theories about how it may have gotten there. It may have become detached from Cooper and it got into the Columbia River or the Lewis River and somehow wound up getting deposited up on that beach shore. It was three stacks of $20 bills. Some of the rubber bands were still intact. And remember, now this has been almost 8.5 years or so, wherever this money's been, and there's still rubber bands there. And you know how those things can degrade. Like in your garage, you could just touch them and they'll just fall apart, but some of the rubber bands were still intact around three bundles of the money. They were stacked on top of each other just below the surface of the sand. So heavily deteriorated, all the corners were missing from them, but for the most part they were intact. You could tell they were $20 bills. The Ingrams found them. They didn't tell anyone at first, so they took them home. I think they tried to to wash them in their sink, trying to clean them up because they were deteriorated, trying to see if they could maybe use the money or not, but they wound up reporting it. So it's still a mystery as to how the money got there. There's a debate whether it was planted to be found. You know, there's a few people out there believe that the plane did fly over this place called the Tina Bar, but that's impossible. The plane was being tracked by radar. Yeah. There were fighter jets that traced it, even though they couldn't, you know, they were too fast for the plane. So they had to keep circling around. They never saw Cooper jump out, but right. It was pretty well documented, the flight path where the plane was, and it did not fly over this particular area. So the debate is whether it was planted by Cooper. Did he plant it later? Did it somehow get into the water stream and somehow washed up? Those theories are hotly debated all the time now.
I want to talk about the potential suspects, but there was one of the suspects, I believe it was it Dwayne Weber? I believe. Was it him that confessed to his wife that he was D.B. Cooper?
Yes. Yes. That was Dwayne Weber. He confessed to his wife, Joe Weber, who's a character. I mean, she's more interesting than I think whoever D.B. Cooper was, because she was a type of woman that would call certain D.B. Cooper researchers like Bruce Smith. We call him the mayor of Cooperville, would call him at like 3 a.m. trying to convince him that Dwayne was Cooper. And most of the hardcore Cooperites never believed that Dwayne was D.B. Cooper, but Joe believed it or seemed to believe it. And her story was that Dwayne had confessed to her that he was Cooper and that she had seen his plane ticket from there. And of course, she can't produce the ticket anymore, unfortunately, yeah, for Joe. Right. And she passed away, I think, 2 years ago. But she was steadfast in her belief that her husband, Dwayne Weber, was Cooper. And then at one point, he took her back out to that area around, around Ariel, Washington, and he kind of retraced the steps of where he supposedly jumped, and pretty much was a deathbed confession to his wife that he was Cooper.
Because there's an HBO documentary that came out a couple of years ago that talks about, I think, at least three different suspects. And yeah,
Dwayne was certainly one of those in the HBO special.
And did he say that he tell her that he planted the money there?
I don't recall if he ever told her that. He did tell her that he was Cooper. She believed it. And God bless her, she would drive everyone crazy about it. She would email anyone interested in the case or the hardcore D.B. Cooper researchers all the time. She seemed to get access to some information that other people didn't know that was credible, not pointing to Dwayne being Cooper, but just some other tidbits that I think did turn out to be true in the case in general. So it's really strange with Joe Weber that she did seem to have some kind of inside source, maybe an FBI person. We don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe trying to find out what other people knew, but she was very eccentric. And I think she's more interesting than most suspects, his wife in and of herself.
Yeah. Often people involved in these type of cases often are. Some of that stuff is just as interesting as the case itself.
Absolutely.
Is there an official position that the FBI says that they think happened to D.B. Cooper, or is there just nothing? What I have heard by some people that they think that there was no way he could have survived the fall and that he died. But is that an official position, or is that more just more speculation?
It's not an official position. Of course, officially the case is closed by the FBI. They have closed the case officially.
Yeah.
The narrative that they put out there, especially early on, that he did die in the jump. He was in no pool and he just artered into the ground somewhere, or he fell into the Columbia River and froze to death and he's fish bait, was a hard narrative put out initially by the FBI. Even though as years go by and we study the case more, it was extremely survivable. In a lot of ways, it was definitely a hazardous jump, but it was very survivable. A lot of research has been done about paratroopers. A guy named Marty Andrade has done a lot of work into paratroopers going into World War II and stuff like D-Day. How high their survival rate was. Of course, those are static line type jumps, but they were the survival rate was really high. I mean, with anti aircraft coming up at those guys, the survival rate from the jumps were very, very high under, you know, hazardous conditions. So there's a lot of things that point to how survivable it was. And they talk about how dense the woods are in that part of southern Washington. And that's really kind of overblown, you know, because like I mentioned, Darren Schaefer, the host of the Cooper Vortex, he's from Woodland, Washington, which is not far from where, you know, the first FBI drop zone was. And he said, you know, it's not like the jungles of Vietnam. You know, he's like, you sure. can find a house not too far away. He said, I'm no mountain man, but if you drop me off in the middle of that stuff, I could get out fairly easily, you know, being from the area. So I think that kind of got blown out of proportion a little bit about how rugged the terrain really was.
Yeah. So the speculation could also be that he was able to get out, find a road and get back to civilization.
Yeah.
Besides the guy that you believe. And I think it's a very strong case. Some of the other people that we can kind of rule out. Like I said, there's Dwayne Weber, Lynn Doyle Cooper, LD Cooper.
Yep.
And Barb Dayton. And these are the ones that I remember from that documentary. And there was mm-hmm. also, was it McCoy? I didn't write that one down, but that actually is kind of a funny story. The copycat essentially of D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, he would have been the first of the real known copycats, or the most well-known copycat was Richard Floyd McCoy. Those are all good. You know, those are all interesting suspects in how people came to know him. Like Barb Dayton was obviously a man who transitioned to a woman. I think he had the first gender reassignment surgery in the state of Washington, I believe. So it's such an interesting story how D.B. Cooper could have been transgendered, but that comes right. from a couple named Ron and Pat Foreman that knew her. And she was a really good pilot, kind of a daredevil herself. And it's just a great, you know, like Seattle/Portland type story where, you know, D.B. Cooper could have been a transgender. And, you know, none of us can put our suspect on the plane. So I don't like to really completely dismiss any suspect, but, you know, I think Barb Dayton is a fan favorite, but not a realistic favorite among, you know, devoted Cooperites.
And LD Cooper, which almost to me sounds like it would be too obvious to give your real name as the.
Yeah, why would he use his real last name? Yeah. You know, LD Cooper was one of the earlier suspects, and he comes from his niece, Marla Cooper, who's a very nice lady. You know, I follow her on Facebook and stuff. Haven't really ever talked to her in person, but she had just, you know, compelling story from when she was a little girl about how her uncle LD and I think it was another uncle, not her father, who came to Thanksgiving that year, because of course Cooper Jump was right before Thanksgiving, and they were bloodied up from something they had done together that looked like it was some kind of crime. And it just made a really great story initially coming from Marla, who's very believable, very pretty lady. That doesn't hurt her case any. It was just a great story about LD. I think he had been in World War II. I don't know if he was a paratrooper or not, but he was from the area. I think his brother did work for Boeing for a while, which was kind of an interesting tie-in. Maybe knew the jet, maybe could have had the knowledge that plane could have been jumped. So it made for a compelling story, and he winds up getting ruled out based on DNA, which they don't have D.B. Cooper's DNA, which was interesting, but they at least acted like they did, and they were able to get some of LD's DNA from a guitar strap that I think Marla was in possession of, and it was negative compared to whatever they thought they had for Cooper, which they don't have, which was kind of unfair to Marla. But, you know, over time, he just kind of faded in the back a little bit as far as suspects go among the really hardcore D.B. Cooper researchers. He kind of takes a back seat. But, you know, I think he's better than some. I really do. You know, D.B. Cooper was described as swarthy, having really dark skin. And that's something LD had more than any of the definite Caucasian suspects. He had really naturally, I mean, I don't know if it's naturally that way or he was in the sun a lot. He had very, very dark skin. He had that going for him, and a great story from his niece. So you know, I would not say LD was ever a bad suspect.
As far as the DNA, some people talked about the cigarette butts.
That's one of the most interesting aspects of this case. So when Cooper hijacked the airplane, he smoked 8 Raleigh filter tip cigarettes.
And back they knew when the you brand could do because that on they an did airplane.
Initially collect them. And that's basically, I think the whole event played out in about 3.5 hours from initially getting on the plane, giving her the notes and hijacking the plane. And then it's circling around SeaTac and then refueling and then taking off. It was, I think, roughly 3.5 hours. I might be off. I'm sure Ryan's correct, trying to correct me right now whenever he listens to this. But, 8 cigarettes is quite a bit in a 3.5 hour span. That's almost the level of a chain smoker. You know, of course, that might have been a way to keep his nerves calm. But really strangely, the FBI lost the cigarette butts. And we don't know exactly when. And this was, of course, way before the advent of DNA. But the FBI just does not destroy evidence like that. Like I say this all the time. If they found a good candidate for Cooper and they said, and it was, you're trying to make a circumstantial case because this is before the age of DNA. And you would say, Mr. Smith, we understand that you smoke. Your friends tell me that you smoke Raleigh filter tip cigarettes. And you said, yeah, so what? They couldn't bring those into court to display as evidence because they've thrown them away. So from what I know, those cigarettes are long gone, thrown away. I remember hearing one rumor that maybe one of the cigarettes survived because someone had taken it home for whatever reason, like a souvenir, and then that might reappear. But I think that was just a fable. I think they were destroyed. There's also, they recovered a hair from the back of the headrest that they believe was D.B. Cooper's, and it was put on like a little small glass slide, and that was bounced around from different places. And now the slide is missing and I think possibly destroyed. I'm not sure. The slide could be still somewhere in hiding in an FBI office, field office, or maybe it made its way to FBI headquarters. We don't know, but they've still never found the hair slide.
And then there's McCoy, who they do talk about also in that HBO documentary. And they talk about, well, it could be him because he actually pulled it off in the next year, 1972. But what they don't go into is just how much of a mess his hijacking was as compared to D.B. Cooper's.
It was a complete mess. It was almost a polar opposite, other than the fact that McCoy hijacked the 727 and jumped out of the aft stair. Other than that, the comparisons end. You know, people talk about how similar it was, and he did do it just months after D.B. Cooper did it. McCoy asked for $500,000, whereas Cooper asked for only $200,000.
Yeah.
McCoy asked for $500,000. He goes under the alias James Johnson, just kind of this benign-sounding name. Winds up hijacking it with a grenade, which is actually a paperweight. It was a fake grenade. He had a pistol, and that's all he used was a pistol and a fake grenade, and winds up hijacking the plane, making the demand for $200,000. I mean, $500,000. And it was a comedy of errors on his particular hijacking, where Cooper was pretty clean. Some people might argue that Cooper made a few mistakes, but he really didn't. He asked for all of the notes back. Cooper was always very calm. Like, everyone that encountered him described him as so calm, which I think really points to who he was. But McCoy was a nervous wreck. The first thing that he did was his wife had typed out his pre-planned hijack instructions, and they were in a manila envelope. And McCoy left that in the waiting area at the airport. So he winds up, he gets on the plane to hijack it. He goes to the lavatory, and an agent for the airline sees this manila envelope laying on a table in the waiting room. So he figures it belongs to a passenger. And I don't know if anything was written on side of it outside that said, "Hey, hijack instructions, Richard," or if it was just a plain envelope. But the person that grabbed it did not look inside, or his whole thing would have been upright then and there.
Right.
Because he would have, "Oh, wait a minute, this is hijack instructions." But he didn't. So the person that worked for the airline walks onto the plane that's already fully loaded now, and he's waving the manila envelope in the air, and he said, "Did anyone leave this in the waiting area?" And McCoy gets out of the bathroom after putting some makeup on and kind of his disguise, so to speak, And he sees that agent waving his hijack instructions in the air, and he quickly claimed it, of course. Those are mine. Those are mine. I mean, can you believe that? I don't think D.B. Cooper would have ever left the hijack instructions in the waiting area, but McCoy did. That's a true story. So that's the first near mishap that could have blown the whole thing up, literally. No pun intended right there. So McCoy gets his envelope back. He winds up sitting close to a guy that's a prisoner that's being transferred somewhere. And this prisoner already can tell something's up. You know, this guy, he's a crook, and he's looking at McCoy like, this guy's really, you know, agitated already. Like, he's already catching this man's suspicion. So McCoy right then and there, you know, just winds up giving his notes. I'm hijacking the plane. Everybody knew it. He had makeup running down his face from trying to disguise himself. He had brought, interestingly enough, one thing Cooper didn't do was bring his own parachute. Cooper took a parachute that was provided to him. Right. McCoy brought his own parachute on board for his hijacking. Although he never got to use it, the ripcord somehow got tied up or hooked on something on the bottom of the plane seat or something like that. It actually deployed in mid-flight, almost knocking out one of the stewardesses getting hit by the canopy as it comes out of its canister under pressure. You know, it almost knocks her down. I mean, this whole hijack was a complete debacle, even though he managed to get to the ground with the money. He winds up jumping out of the aft stair like Cooper did. He lands somewhere not far from where he lives, and I think it was a Provo in Utah. He's a Mormon, so he lives in Utah. So he doesn't, you know, in much better conditions he jumped in than Cooper did, by the way. So McCoy gets to the ground, despite all his mistakes, he gets to the ground with all the money. He winds up hiding the money in a culvert, and he winds up hitchhiking a ride from a 16-year-old boy named Pete Zimmerman. And Pete Zimmerman retells the story about when he picks McCoy up. And he said McCoy was really agitated. He took him to get a milkshake at this drive-thru. And then McCoy has Pete Zimmerman drive him home to like just a couple of blocks or so away from where he actually lived. So not real smart. He winds up going back to get the money where he hit it, the culvert. And he's quickly caught because the news is everywhere. And the funniest thing about Richard Foy McCoy is that at the time that he hijacked that plane, he was working for the Utah State Guard as a helicopter pilot. He had been a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, so he came back when he was back to Utah, and he was flying for the Utah State Guard as a helicopter pilot. So he was actually called into work to look for himself. He's flying a helicopter around looking for himself, which I love that part of the McCoy story. So it quickly got out that, you know, he quickly gets caught he left a fingerprint on the plane, a clear fingerprint. And of course, his fingerprints were on file from being in the military, in the Army. And that got traced to him. And then his picture was out there, got shown by Pete Zimmerman, saw it and said, that's definitely the guy that I gave a ride to that night. His best friend, a guy named Van Iperin, couldn't believe it, but said, yeah, you know, Richard was telling me that how if he ever hijacked an airplane like D.B. Cooper, he wouldn't ask for a paltry $200,000. He'd ask for $500,000, even though Van Iperin could not believe that his friend did that, because Richard Foy McCoy was a devout Mormon. He was a Mormon Sunday school teacher. Lived among the Mormon community, and it meant a lot to him. And that's just not something a good Mormon boy does, is hijack an airplane for cash. But McCoy quickly got caught from all his mistakes, leaving the fingerprint, other mistakes he made. And they recovered all but about, I think, $10 of the $500,000. He eventually gets tried for the crime. Some people think the judge was a little too harsh on him because he was a Mormon, and they thought the judge was anti-Mormon. But McCoy breaks out of prison after being convicted. He fashions a gun out of dental paste, which was actually kind of smart. With a couple other guys, they break out with a garbage truck and a fake gun. And he's holed up somewhere in, I think, Virginia Beach, Virginia, and gets in a shootout with the FBI. And one FBI agent winds up killing McCoy with a shotgun. It was actually his personal shotgun for that FBI agent, which is kind of a no-no to kill a suspect with your personal weapon. But so that ends Richard Foy McCoy right there. That's how he's killed in a shootout after being on the run. But it was a fascinating story.
There really is an interesting cast of characters that swirls around the D.B. Cooper thing. There really is just
an interesting each suspect cast on their characters. Own is fascinating. McCoy, right. Like Barb Dayton, we talked about. Each one of them, you could write a book about. Oh, McCoy had a book written about him called The Real McCoy, about how a couple guys just trying to make his strongest case for being D.B. Cooper. But Barb Dayton has a book that was written by her friend, the Foremans. They're all worthy of a book. Oh, these people are so, just, you know, they're all out of central casting. You know, they all deserve to be suspects in some way or another.
Yeah, I just now I kind of have a much more harder time believing that it would be McCoy, just as bumbling as the
bumbling
the attempt was.
Bumbling and a nervous wreck. And remember, McCoy was a he was a Green Beret, was in Special Forces. He did a tour in 1964 as part of a demo team. And then he does a second tour later. He comes back from that first tour. He's working for a while. He's married. And he does a second tour as a helicopter pilot. He winds up getting a Distinguished Flying Cross, which is a very, you know, one of the highest medals you can get as a pilot for bravery. He was shooting up, there was some North Vietnamese army camp that he shot up. I think they had some American POWs there. And McCoy went in with that helicopter without you know, any hesitation shooting that up. He was very, very brave. I talked to a guy that was in Vietnam with him and said, you know, Richard had guts, you know, he was not scared of anything. But yet when he did his hijacking, he was a nervous wreck. He called attention to himself. His makeup was coming off. He left the, like I said, he left his hijack instructions in the waiting area. Those are mistakes made by a guy that's nervous. And for rightly so, he's going to jump out of a plane after stealing $500,000. But that's the difference between D.B. Cooper, hijacking and Richard Floyd McCoy's. But Cooper was by all accounts so cool under pressure. Everybody that encountered him, mainly the flight attendant, said that he was calm at all times. He was a little agitated when they didn't bring the money in a knapsack that he had asked for. It was in a bank bag. And he got a little kind of antsy when the refueling process took a little longer than what he thought it should take. Cooper did inquire if there were flight air marshals on board. But other than that, he was cool as a cucumber. And that's not what McCoy was during his hijacking. And then there's other things, too, that leaned against McCoy, such as the fact that when he did it, of course, they got his photographs in front of the entire flight crew of Flight 305, the Cooper flight, and not one of them said the hijacker resembled Richard Floyd McCoy. Right. Not one. Not one even said he looked similar. And then you get to the fact that Richard Floyd McCoy had a pretty distinct North Carolina accent. That's where he grew up. That's where he's from. He had a lisp because he was missing the flap under his tongue because it was too taut when he was growing up as a kid. And when they removed it, it gave him a permanent lisp. And one of the main things is that he was a devout Mormon. Devout Mormons do not order alcohol as D.B. Cooper did and drank it or smoke. So there's little things like that that the pro McCoy people never like to bring up. And like I said, I did talk to somebody that was a Green Beret with Richard Floyd McCoy in Vietnam. And I said, did you ever see him smoke in Vietnam? He said, no, he was a devout Mormon. No way. Never touched him. I mean, you think if he was going to be a closet smoker or what they call a Jack Mormon, meaning a Mormon that kind of cheats a little bit. You would do it in Vietnam, you know, under that kind of pressure. But he said never saw him touch a drink or a cigarette while he was in Vietnam.
It's interesting how with all these suspects, how the Vietnam War is a common denominator between a lot of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which are three guys I think of that are, you know, have Vietnam ties. And one being Richard Floyd McCoy had Vietnam ties. And another suspect named Robert Rackstraw was a Vietnam combat vet as well. But one thing that Rackstraw has in common with McCoy is that they were both young at the time. McCoy was 28, I believe, and I think Rackstraw was 27 years old. Everybody that saw Cooper said they were middle-aged.
Right.
So, you know, the McCoy supporters say, well, McCoy looked older than his age, you know, but people looked a little bit, you know, a little bit older than they were back then by age. But, you know, by concept alone of his voice and things that he talked about, with Tina Mucklow's, the person that spent the most time with DB Cooper, lit his cigarettes. She's the prime witness in the case. She's still alive. You think she was 23 years old at the time? Could have told, could have been able to tell she was talking to a 28-year-old or a 27-year-old, and wouldn't later describe him as middle-aged, even if he did look a little older for his age.
Sure.
Was he speaking in terms of a middle-aged man? Probably not. So that's a big strike against two of the top three Vietnam suspects.
Right. And your suspect is a Vietnam vet. He would have been the right age.
He was the right age. He was 43 years old at the time of the hijacking in 71. So yeah, he was that age. And back then, you just didn't see, even it drop zones for sport parachuting, which was really still in its infancy in the early 1970s. This was young guys doing that. I mean, it was a crazy sport, still is, but in the early 70s, it was still very young as a sport. And a lot of these guys already knew each other, even from different drop zones from state to state. They knew a lot of the instructors, a lot of people in common, and it was unheard of to see a man in his mid-40s, even sport parachuting back then. And for the military as well. Average age of a Vietnam soldier when they got to the, got sent to Vietnam was 19 years old.
Right.
Special forces guys were average age was about 21, 22, because they had a little more training. To become special forces. So a guy in his mid-40s making that jump is already an anomaly.
And also to the name DB Cooper, it's come to us as DB Cooper, but he buys a ticket under Dan Cooper. And the
Yeah.
name Dan Cooper actually does have some significance.
It could, we don't know, of course. Yes, he bought the ticket under Dan Cooper. DB came from I think it was Associated Press screw up, because when they,
Yeah.
had the name Dan Cooper, I think someone had found it in a news place. Well, we found a guy named a DB Cooper that lived out somewhere outside of Portland, I think. And that got heard over, picked up over a broadcast or something like that. And someone re-reported it as DB. And so the name just kind of stuck, and now it's legend. But of course, he bought the ticket under Dan Cooper, so it was always Dan Cooper. But some people surmise he may have taken the name from a Franco-Belgian comic book called Dan Cooper, which is about a fictitious Canadian pilot for the Royal Canadian Air Force. And that comic book really was only abundant in Belgium because it was written in French. I think there was maybe, there was never one in English. There might have been one in another language. I can't remember what it was, but some people think that you could have bought them in Canada, and especially in a place like Quebec where they speak French, but that's never been proven. But it was written by a guy named Albert Weinberg since the 1950s. And there's the guy was a fighter pilot, and there's a few of the covers where he's actually parachuting and stuff.
Yeah.
So some believe that he took the name from the comic book, and I'm open to that, but I think he probably just came up with a name on the spot that was, not real rememberable.
So let's talk about your suspect and the subject of your book, which is Ted Braden, and
Yes.
who he was and what possibly lends him to being DB Cooper.
Well, Ted Braden got on my radar because like I was telling you in the beginning, I'd gotten, I was always into the case. Never thought I would write about it or get too hardcore or really, ever start, being active on the message boards like a Drop Zone or the DB Cooper forum. I enjoyed reading them, but I never, wanted to actually log in and go back and forth with these guys that were always fighting each other, arguing over suspects. But I got reinvigorated in the case. Like I said, from listening to Galen Cook and learning about his suspect, Wolfgang Gossett, and he made a good case for this guy. And I thought, hey, maybe this guy's figured it out. He's a very articulate, smart lawyer. So that kind of reinvigorated me into the case. And then not long after that, a documentary about Robert Rackstraw came out called DB Cooper Case Closed. And I was hope when I started watching that show, I was like, hey, I hope this guy figured it out. Started with a compelling story, but then towards the end of that show, it was on the History Channel. His whole suspect and case kind of falls apart on him towards the end. So I was a little let down. So, but that did rekindle my interest in all things D.B. Cooper. So I'm reading one of the D.B. Cooper message boards one day, and a guy named Bruce Smith, who I know very well now, who we call the mayor of Cooperville, he wrote a book called D.B. Cooper and the FBI. He was talking back and forth on the message boards with another researcher that just goes under the name Snowman. And I don't even know if Bruce knows Snowman's real name, but that's just who he posts under. And they were talking about this guy named Ted B. Braden. And everything I read just fascinated me, that said that, when things started becoming declassified with the Black Ops unit in Vietnam called MACV SOG, stands for Military Assistance Command Studies and Observations Group, that, you know, they signed 20-year NDAs because this was a group never talked about, because they were doing things in Laos, which was against the Geneva Accord and everything like that. So it was not supposed to be talked about. It was the real Black Ops unit. And I love all things Vietnam and Special Forces. And I'd never heard of this group before at the time that I saw this. And they're talking about this guy that was in it, and how his name came up because people like Bruce and Snowman, and I don't know if anyone else, started asking these guys that were in this group, MACV SOG, because these were the toughest of the tough of the Green Berets. I mean, there you had your regular Special Forces, and then you had the Black Ops guys, which were a cut above. The baddest of the badasses. And they were asking different guys that had served in that group that they could find online, like, you know, hey, people have often said that D.B. Cooper hijacked looked like a covert type Special Forces operation. Was there anybody among you that you thought could have been D.B. Cooper? And like Bruce wrote about in one of his articles on the Mountain News, he said one name always came rushing to the forefront every time one of these guys was asked who they thought Cooper was. And that name was Ted B. Braden. It was never Richard McCoy from another Special Forces. It was never a number two guy. Well, you know, it was always Ted B. Braden. And the belief among these former Special Forces guys that Braden was Cooper was so high that it was just remarkable how they were all convinced. I mean, because a lot of these guys could have pulled the jump off, because they were trained at being thrown out of helicopters and stuff in the middle of the night. They were being thrown into Laos, where they were totally sterile. You didn't have dog tags because our government couldn't admit that you were over there. So
right.
If you got caught over there, you were dead. If they couldn't rescue you, you were dead. So these guys knew that going in. So that's how tough you had to be.
And this is basically because the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yes.
That the North Vietnamese were supplying through Laos and Cambodia into South Vietnam.
Yeah, they were having unfettered use of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, going down there, delivering supplies down to the south part of Vietnam, and arming guys, arming the Viet Cong. And, it's just creating a huge problem. So, yeah, that was the main reason to get these guys in there, is to stop that easy use of the Ho Chi Minh Trail by doing things like prisoner snatches, getting our guys out, sabotaging things. They were leaving dummy weapons over there that when you shot our dummy ammo, or you put it in the gun and it would blow up on you. Any kind of stuff like that they could do is what they did. And one of the main things they would do is wiretapping in Laos. And it was actually Ted Braden's team, which was called Team Colorado. He was a team leader. He was called a 1-0, is what a team leader was over there. And then the 1-1 would be the assistant team leader, and the 1-2 would be like a radio man. It was three Americans on a small team. And the rest was filled out by what they would call indigenous personnel to the areas of Southeast Asia, mainly a group called the Mountain Yards, which was a name from the French that meant mountain people, was the main ethnic tribe that would fill out these what they call SOG teams. And Braden was a team leader of Team Colorado in 1965, and they did the first successful wiretap in Laos by getting a lot of important information that they, you know, they had to go up on a pole and do all this. Of course, they were being hunted as soon as they hit the ground, because the NBA knew those guys were over there and they were looking for them. And a lot of, you know, there was a lot of their locations would sometimes get leaked and whatever, but very tough work, very, very tough work. So just learning about MACV SOG and Ted Braden got me hooked, because I'm like, these guys are saying he could be Cooper. That gets my attention, especially legends in this group. I got like Billy Waugh, who's called the Godfather of Special Forces. This guy was one of the toughest ever lived. He had 8 Purple Hearts, more awards than you could list. He spent 50 years between Vietnam Special Forces and CIA Black Ops. And Billy, I talked to him personally. He passed away, I think, a year and a half ago. No, 2 years ago or so. Told me personally that he firmly believed Ted Braden was DB Cooper. A guy named John Plaster believed that Braden was Cooper. Real famous Vietnam Special Forces guy, a sniper trainer. And by hearing these guys' stories about how convinced they were that Braden was Cooper, I wanted to take it to the next level. I wanted to find out everything I could about this guy, because I was Cooper or not, I was fascinated by him already. Because Billy Wall had made the comment that Ted Braden had balls of steel. And I mean, that's coming from Billy Wall, one of the most decorated soldiers in history. I said, this guy has balls of steel. I go, that's what Cooper had, in my opinion. And another thing that kept coming up about Braden and people that fought with him in Vietnam that knew him said that he had an unusual calmness under fire. He would never get rattled. He was always as calm as he could be. He literally had no fear of death. One night he slept on the edge of an NVA bunker in Laos for like 3 hours. If they found him, not only were they going to kill him, they were going to torture him for as long as they could if they got one of those guys over there. But he just had no fear. He would walk on open trails in Laos, which was a huge no-no. You did not walk on an open trail because then they could start tracking you. But he just had no fear of this. So the more I learned about him, the more I got enthralled. So I tried to push the envelope on everything that was ever known about Ted Braden. So that's what basically led up to the book.
And he's in Vietnam, and he had also been he had also at 16, lying about his age, was in World War II,
Yep.
and he was a paratrooper.
He's a paratrooper
Good
at
as
World War
well.
II. Like you said, he lied about his age. He was six, just had turned 16 at the time. He had his aunt go with him, who kind of took care of him because he had a bit of a rough childhood living with his stepfather, who was kind of abusive to him. And his mother would take long trips with her father because his mother's mother died in childbirth when she had given birth to Ted's mother. So he had often would be at home with his stepbrother and or his half brother, sorry, his half brother and his stepfather, who did not treat him too well. He treated his own son pretty well, but not poor old Ted. So Ted just wanted to get out of that situation, winds up joining to go fight in World War II at age 16, joins the 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, gets qualified airborne. And he goes over to fight in World War II just after D-Day, but he catches the end of the war during the Battle of the Bulge, fighting in a lot of the battles over there. My friend Ryan Burns found a rare account of Ted Braden in World War II, which was a needle in the haystack to find it. And it talked about how he was with his unit. He was with the 704th Parachute Infantry Division, B Battalion, E Company, and that was Easy Company, kind of like the famed Band of Brothers unit. But all E's were Easy Company. But he was in the same basic, larger group than the Band of Brothers group was at age 16. But in this account, they talked about how young Ted at 16 would go out to the listening post to watch the German soldiers go by, trying to get surveillance on them. And he'd do this by himself without any concern for his safety at age 16, just on pure adrenaline. He would go out there to watch these German soldiers go by. So he's in active combat at age 16. He gets 2 personal bronze stars from being in combat over there, manages not to get killed, and he's basically comes home a war hero after that. Before his 18th birthday, he's already a war hero and goes to college for a couple of years. He's originally from Toledo, Ohio, and all he knows is the adrenaline he liked in the military. So he has this on again, kind of off again love affair with being in the military. And he knows he's really great at one thing that they taught him, which was how to jump out of an airplane. And he winds up being so good at it that he's teaching what's called HALO, which is high altitude, low opening parachuting techniques that he learned. He was a member of the Golden Arrows which was the first military sport diving team that did competitions all over Europe. And Ted would often win most of these. He was so good at skydiving. He would win these competitions everywhere. He was just probably the best parachutist that was ever in the Army.
Yeah, I mean, and you make the point in the book and some of your videos that he is the one that had so much experience with what he did, and really was the guy that we could have been the one that pulls this off. There's this.
Easily, he could have done it blindfolded, and that's.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing that kept me hooked on him, which I still am, of course, is that among MACV SOGs, and there was around 12 or 1300 total men that were ever in that elite unit. Others could have done that jump because these guys were all highly trained. They were all badasses, but they were like Braden was in his own league, and it was just he had a criminal mindset. And they knew that he was a convicted felon later on. He when he was in Vietnam, he was always working the black market for extra money. He didn't fight for glory, not in Vietnam. He was over there to make money, period. I mean, that's all he ever wanted to do was score an extra buck. So he constantly worked the black market. He was hanging around with the CIA boys in Saigon quite a bit. The plane would take him back to the camp wherever he was with his other guys, and it would often dip its wing, meaning Ted's coming back, CIA's dropping him off. But not just the fact that he had the skills better than any other known suspect, but it's just something that they believed he would do, that he would come up with that caper and actually follow through with it. And that's something that separates Ted Braden from any other DB Cooper suspect is that I personally have talked to nine people who knew him personally that are all convinced he was DB Cooper.
Yeah.
Nobody else can really say that. I mean, McCoy's young kids at the time might believe that later, but they were like 1 and 5 years old. But these are grown people that knew him as grown adults at the time that knew him. And these are separate groups of people that don't even know each other that got together like, hey, do you think it's Ted? And that's not what happened here. It's different people from different times of his life are convinced he was DB Cooper, such as his jumping partner from the Golden Arrows sport team in the Army, a guy named Al Tyre that I talked to. Unfortunately, he passed away from a stroke about 3 years ago, but I got to talk to Al at length. And Al's story, I keep going back to Al's story of running into Ted Braden at a truck stop in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and seeing Ted up at the bar having lunch. And Al walks in and says, "Ted Braden," because he notices him, and Ted, almost kind of startled by it, winds up having an hours-long conversation with Al. Ted Braden's driving a truck at that time in 73 for Pittsburgh Plate Glass, and they're in the cab of the truck, and this was. And Al's just such a good guy, ex-military veteran himself, had a really good life. And he's telling me the story about sitting in the cab of his truck. And Ted Braden says to Al Tyre, said, "Hey, what did you think of that DB Cooper thing?" And, as a parachutist to another. And Al said, "Yeah, I heard about it, but Al just wasn't that interested in it." And he said that Ted was just really dejected that Al didn't light up about the whole DB Cooper thing. And, I think it was almost a near confession. I don't think Braden would have ever confessed, but I think he was trying to signal to Al that it was him. And years later, Al Tyre's at a parachute club at an Army base, and Parachutist magazine was out and had an article about DB Cooper and the famous sketch. I don't know if it was what we call composite A or B that was in that magazine, but when Al Tyre saw it, he just almost fell to the floor. It hit him right then and there. Yeah, Ted was Cooper. And he believed it for the rest of his life until he died. He was fully convinced that Braden was Cooper. Just, he said it was that look of the sketch. He just what Ted was like, what he would do, what he said to him in the cab of that truck, made a huge believer out of Al Tyre.
You also point out this could be debatable, but his last wife said that Braden was DB Cooper.
She did. She said that to her youngest daughter. Her name's Camille. She lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. I was really lucky to get Camille to talk to me because I don't think she really remembered her stepfather very favorably. She has I think two older sisters that knew him, which I'd love to talk to as well, but I never had that opportunity. But I did get to discuss them with his youngest stepdaughter at the time. And she did, you know, say that her mother told her, her name was Pauline Braden, they had stayed married. Even though they had a really a rocky relationship, they were separated for different periods of for long periods of time, but they never officially got divorced. And Pauline kept the name. But she said, yes, Pauline did say that he told her he was D.B. Cooper and it was a confession. But by the time that Pauline had told her daughter that, she had the early starts of dementia. So she said, you know, she did believe it, but you have to take into account that she was starting to get get some lighter dementia. Unfortunately, but the family, including Camille's son, they all knew that through the years that they believed that he was Cooper and that he had told the mother that, and that she could even remember when she was young in 1971, they were living in a penthouse in Chicago. She had always wondered how they had the money they had. They both drove, her mother and Ted both drove newer Mercedes. They had a penthouse. And she's like, how does a long haul truck driver make that kind of money? But you have to consider that Ted was committing other felonies. Of course, D.B. Cooper committed a felony, so it just ties in. But he was doing things like arranging to have his load stolen and then splitting the money. He got caught for stealing some fish and meat. But the interesting about Ted Braden is that every time he got caught or in trouble, he got let go. He knew too much. He had high up friends at the State Department. He knew all the illegal activities that were going on in Vietnam, a lot of stuff that probably never got, you know, told to this day, but he had access to all that because he was doing things for the CIA. You know, and I was told that he had not only secrets from Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, but Ted knew globally a lot of things that the CIA was doing. So they think that's just one thing that kept him out of trouble. They didn't want him talking. In addition to having some powerful friends like General Jack Singlob, who he knew from the early 60s from being a member of the Golden Arrows and seeing him at the Parachute Club for the 5th Division and telling World War II stories, because Singlob, of course, came out of something called the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor to the Special Forces, and he later co-founded the CIA. So it's a good friend to have.
I'd say so, absolutely. He knows some of this because of this episode that happens where he basically deserts
from
Vietnam at the end of 1966, and ends up going to the Congo and tries to enlist as a mercenary.
Yes.
You know, and so there is that too, you know, and basically the CIA kind of, the CIA kind of just kicks him out of there. But you also use some linguistic comparisons too.
I love using the phrases that Ted Braden used, which we only know because he, you know, there was a lengthy article about Ted Braden, and I know people that are just listening to this can't see it, but I'm holding an original copy of Ramparts magazine, has a picture of John Lennon on the front wearing an army uniform like he's in Vietnam, but this was the October 1967 issue of Ramparts, and this in Ramparts was a magazine that was kind of like, you know, they're very anti-Vietnam War. And their military editor was a guy named Don Duncan, who was former Special Forces in Vietnam, who turned down a promotion after he finished a tour. And he became very disillusioned with what was going on in Vietnam. So he wound up becoming like a big advocate for all things anti-Vietnam War. And he winds up interviewing Ted Braden for an article in the magazine because he had known Braden from Vietnam. And it's a fascinating article that talks about him being, you know, deserting from Vietnam. He goes, comes back to the United States. He goes over to Belgium and he gets recruited into 5 Commando. And he's fighting in the Congo for a short period of time. And like you mentioned, he got the CIA found out about it, gets arrested. They take him back to Fort Dix. And I know the story there because I know the guy that oversaw him at Fort Dix, a good friend of mine, who told where that story picked up. Going back to the linguistics, Ted writes half of the article. The first half is Don Duncan kind of giving you the background on Braden and how he knew him. and talks about him. And then the second part is Braden talking about going to the Congo. And when Braden's talking about some of the things back in Vietnam, he uses all these really interesting phrases about, you know, how he would insult people. He called the agency boys in Saigon, he called them chair-bound commandos. And he had all these interesting ways of insulting people. And it's so similar to what we call D.B. Cooper letter number 6, because that's an interesting letter. Of course, there was letters written after the D.B. Cooper hijacking, which most are believed to be hoaxes, are just people that were having fun.
That's a part of this that I had no idea. I didn't know that there were letters that were ascribed to D.B. Cooper.
There were six of them that are mostly known. One actually had little cutout letters from Playboy magazine, and it, you know, wasn't handwritten at all. It was each little individual letters cut out from different ads, and they actually found the actual issue of Playboy where they were cut from. And it said, I am D.B. Cooper, it said the system that beats the system, all this kind of cryptic stuff. But they were always signed D.B. Cooper. And that's something that I always thought was odd, because that was never his name. He gave the name Dan Cooper, which we're pretty sure wasn't his real name, right?
It's so reminiscent of the Zodiac stuff.
It's reminiscent, yes, with the letters. It is, right, for sure. Although most of the Zodiac letters are considered to have actually been written by the Zodiac, other than a few, most of the Cooper letters are considered just to be, you know, forgeries, but we have no one to match it to. But one thing that I always thought was odd about at least the first five were that they were always signed D.B. Cooper. And I would be like, you know, that's the name that caught on, but he gave the name Dan Cooper. I never thought he'd be that excited about latching onto a name that he didn't use, which is another reason I like the sixth letter that came out. And this letter talks about, I had to do something with the skills that Uncle taught me. And that just really grabbed my attention. Like, what, Uncle? Who's Uncle? And the skills that Uncle taught you. And what he's talking about is the military. The military. He's talking about Uncle Sam taught you how to jump out of a plane. And that's how that letter reads. And it's, I had to do something to relieve the frustration. So don't bother going to look for me. You know, tell the lackey cops to quit looking for me. There's the phrase lackey cops that was in D.B. Cooper letter number 6. That sounds like something Ted Braden would say all day long. It says, it uses the term world idiots. You know, he's talking about the government, and he uses the term world idiots. Like, what is a world idiot? That's we know what idiot means, but what's a world idiot? He's talking about someone that's traveled all around the world. This is CIA, how the CIA controls everything. They controlled the mercenary wars in the Congo that he wrote about in Ramparts. They control everything. They go into different governments and they play both sides. This is what the CIA does. I think that's what he's referring to in that letter. World idiots, lackey cops. That's just how Braden would insult people, like chair-bound commandos and Ramparts, incompetent Vietnamese officers and officials. You know, he'd use a lot of alliteration in these. So in my book, I do a comparison of Ramparts versus D.B. Cooper letter number 6. And, you know, in D.B. Cooper's number 6, anyway, shortens Uncle Sam to something, you know, the skills that Uncle taught me. In Ramparts, he uses a line where he just says Sam, and he's clearly referring to Uncle Sam. And that's not common to break up Uncle Sam between Uncle and Sam. It's really linguistically similar the way that Braden wrote compared to that letter number 6. And it was signed a rich man. It was not signed D.B. Cooper. It said, by the way, D.B. Cooper is not my real name. He says that in the letter. D.B. Cooper is not my real name. It signs sincerely a rich man. And that's just something that Braden would write. I don't know why he would write it, but it sounds exactly how he wrote things. So that was one of the better pieces, I thought, was comparing that letter to the Ramparts article,
right?
Which was Ramparts was written way before the hijacking. So it's not like he was trying to alter his speech to make people think he was Cooper.
Yeah, and you point out that he calls Duncan Dunk.
Yes. You know,
so it's very similar to saying Unk and then
Unk and Dunk. Yeah.
Yeah.
So good with Unk. I think Unk was in the Cooper letter, and he calls Don Duncan Dunk, and that was never his nickname in Vietnam. His name was Don. It was short enough. You didn't need to shorten it. And that's something that Dead Braden would do to act like he knew you better than he did. But, you know, like, hey, I could call you Dunk and no one else does. You know, like, you're my buddy. Of course, he was going to hit Donald Duncan up for some money, because that's what Ted Braden's whole quest in life was an extra dollar, no matter how he could get it. If it was done by criminal means, all the better. I mean, his whole reason for it, his whole impetus for even being DB Cooper, you don't need it. I mean, it's written right here in this magazine. It's all about how he was always looking to make an extra dollar in Vietnam, in the Congo. He went to fight in the Congo as a mercenary because they paid more than what he was making as a sergeant first class in Vietnam. It was all about the money. This is motive. I mean, everybody needs a motive. What was DB Cooper's motive? Money. If it was Ted Braden, his motive was written about years earlier in this magazine. So he's got motive all day long. Convicted felon. Of course, it's a circumstantial case I make for Braden. Like Mark Messer likes to remind me, you can't put him on the plane, even though Mark does like Braden as a suspect. I know he does, because he even asked Billy Wall about him. But you can't put any of these guys on the plane. You can't put Kenny Christensen on the plane. You can't put McCoy on the plane. If we could, this would already be solved. If somebody saw one of the known suspects on the plane or tied him into DNA or anything else, this is solved. But to this day, it's a circumstantial case. Braden's case, of course, is circumstantial, but I think it's a strong one. I can't put him in Portland, but boy, if I could around that time period, I think it's a game, set, match.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, if anyone could possibly put him in Portland.
I am working on it with another researcher kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
He's got a great theory about, and believes it's Braden, a really smart person I'm working with that found me and it got, you know, sucked into the vortex and listened to every episode of the Cooper Vortex and listened to my, I've done that show twice with Darren, and she locked into Braden, and Darren has covered every suspect you could think of, probably more than once. He's done McCoy a lot. He's done at least two or three on Weber. And the guy that I can't remember the gentleman's name that makes a case for Weber. It wasn't Joe. I think he actually did it after Joe had passed away, but he knew Joe Weber. And he makes a great case for Dwayne Weber, who's otherwise not a great suspect. But he makes a good, passionate case for Joe Weber. But Darren covers every suspect under the sun in that show, good, bad, or ugly, because it's just about getting the story out. You know, Barb Dayton's covered. Walter Recca, who's terrible.
Here's what I wonder, and I wonder this about the Zodiac Killer as well, which I think is extremely likely that the Zodiac Killer was two people.
I won't disagree there.
Is there a possibility that if it was Braden, that one guy did the hijacking, one guy jumped out the plane? That's established. But is there a possibility that there could have been accomplices that he might have had on the ground, and it could have been some of these other guys?
Bruce Smith really likes that theory. Bruce knows the case well. Bruce is a big conspiracy guy, which ties into your show. And like Bruce said, if you like conspiracies and you like DB Cooper, your suspect's Ted Braden all day long. He is the conspiratorial suspect because he's the guy that the CIA does not want you to know about. They don't want you to know the guy ever existed because he knew a lot of stuff. And if Braden was Cooper, and I do believe he was, they could not tell you he was DB Cooper because they cannot arrest him and keep him in jail for an extended period of time, because he's gonna talk about what he knows. He's gonna have a friend like Singlob get him out. He's had other friends in the State Department. He's got powerful friends, and he just cannot be held against his will if he doesn't like it. He's gonna talk. He's gonna dead man switch, whatever. I mean, because a lot of people say, why wouldn't they just kill him if they're worried about what he knew? Well, he might have had a friend that was gonna put some letters in the mail. And whatever Braden knew, it was some pretty big-time stuff. I mean, he might have had lots of knowledge of assassinations, not only in Vietnam, but anywhere.
Well, I mean, and that in 1971, I don't know. I mean, I think the Pentagon Papers that had maybe dropped at that point, but in 1971, I don't think too many people knew what was really going on in Laos and Cambodia, the
Oh, I had
Nation of
no idea.
Israel. I don't think too many people knew what the CIA involvement was in Africa.
No, they did not know.
Yeah.
And they didn't like people talking about it. That's why when the CIA found out that Braden was fighting as a mercenary down there, they wanted him picked up quick. And of course, he deserts from Vietnam. He's a deserter. He's listed as a deserter. I mean, in certain wars, if you got caught being a deserter, the punishment was hanging. It's a very serious offense. And he gets taken back to the United States. He's confined at Fort Dix for a while. And he's in his jail cell there. He's overlooked by a guy named Hank Birch, who I know well. He's still alive. Who was I think maybe a lieutenant back then. He later became a captain. But he's overseeing Braden in confinement at Fort Dix, New Jersey, in the stockade. And he remembers Ted Braden had cigars in his jail cell, and that was unheard of at Fort Dix. He has cigars. It would never give you anything like that there because the prisoners would clog up the toilets with stuff like cigarette butts, cigars, whatever they could get their hands on. So
Yeah.
they just weren't allowed. But yet Braden had these nice cigars while in his jail cell. He had a television set in
Right.
1960, late, that was in 67, had a, or late 66, had a television, no, early 67, sorry, in his jail cell. That is true. From Hank Birch, he's like, this was unheard of. So it comes the time for Braden to be court-martialed for desertion. And a guy named Harold K. Johnson, who was the head of the army at the time, I mean, the only person higher than him at all was the president of the United States, calls down to Fort Dix and says, we're not going to have the court-martial for Ted Braden today. And they were like, why not? Well, we don't have enough MPs to support the secure the courtroom. And Hank was like, are you kidding? This place is crawling with MPs. This is Fort Dix. You could look out the window and see 20 of them. So it was just something contrived they came up with. But Harold K. Johnson was the head of the army at the time, and he's intervening on the behalf of Ted Braden, the deserter. And they basically wound up just letting him go with a general discharge under honorable conditions, meaning he could still be buried in Arlington. And a deserter really gets a sweet deal like that. And Braden actually balks at getting that deal because they took his special wristwatch, which we still don't know what it did. But he says, I'm not doing anything to give me my watch back. But apparently he never got the watch back, but took the deal. But, he was just like, so what? I mean, a deserter got discharge under honorable conditions after desertion. So it shows you right there the kind of pull that he had and who was intervening on his behalf, including Harold K. Johnson at the time. So it's proven that he had these high contacts, either because they liked him or they feared him or a combination of both. So if he's Cooper, they cannot arrest him. They're not going to show his photographs to the flight attendants, because if they say that's him, that's the man, then you got to arrest him, and he's going to have to do at least 10 years or whatever it may be. But he never. The interesting thing is so many of the FBI 302s have been released now. Ryan Burns has a searchable database for those FBI 302s, and there's a lot of documents on the Cooper case. Braden's name never comes up once. I mean, he would have been a natural just coming out of the army and what Special Forces said they believe was DB Cooper, but there's not one reference to Ted Braden in there. And it's not just because he was in a covert unit that is now unclassified. They could have just redacted that, but his name comes up, does not come up at all in one FBI 302 document. Now that's telling. That's actually more in his favor than it is not, because if he comes up and say, well, we looked at him and we determined he was in Ohio at the time of the hijacking, it doesn't come up. His name never comes up, and several other suspects do. And they talk about why they were ruled out or this and that, but Braden never comes up at all, despite being the number one pick from, I mean, anyone in Special Forces, 5th Special Forces and SOG, who believe they was DB Cooper, doesn't come up in the FBI documents at all. I think that's telling.
Yeah. Also, too, I mean, I think the element is too that, like, basically, if we believe that letter too, that just like Uncle Sam trained this guy to do this.
Yeah.
You
know?
He gave him the skill set. Yeah.
The skills that Uncle taught him, he had to do it to, it says to do it to relieve himself of frustration. He was frustrated. He had a grudge. D.B. Cooper said on the plane, he had a grudge. He told Tina Mucklow, the flight attendant, that she said, "Why do you have a grudge against our airline?" And Cooper's response was, "No, I just have a grudge." And of course, what was Braden's grudge? He could not, and taking that deal and getting that general discharge under honorable conditions, he had to sign that he could never, ever join the military again. And that's all he really knew.
Right. That was his life. Yeah.
That was his life, jumping out of airplanes. So what is he going to do? I'm going to use these skills that Uncle taught me, and I'm going to rob a 727 of 200 grand. And that's another thing, going back to the whole story. At the time that D.B. Cooper did that, it wasn't widely known, and actually it was top secret knowledge, that that particular plane could be jumped like that. The only people that time it had ever been done was some test flights over Thailand back during the Vietnam days. Only a few people knew that could be done. The pilots did not know it could be done. That's why they refused to take off with the aft staircase down. Of course, Cooper wanted the staircase down because it would have been easier to jump out with it down. And he knew that the plane could take off the stair down. But he relented and let them raise it. Because if he can't get the stair down in flight, he's in a metal jail cell. You know, so there's some stress there, because something could go wrong with the hydraulic or whatever that lowers that staircase in flight. Of course, he did get it down and famously jumped. But he knew that plane could be jumped, and these special forces guys, certain ones in Vietnam, knew that plane could be jumped. I talked to at least a few of the guys that knew Braden in Vietnam, said, yeah, he would have known that for sure. I knew it. A guy like Leonard Tilley told me that. He goes, I knew it could be jumped. And he didn't even like Ted Braden, but he goes, yeah, I firmly believe Ted Braden was D.B. Cooper. He said, I'd bet my home, my Distinguished Service Cross, and my life. He said, my home, my Distinguished Service Cross that he got for valor in Vietnam, and my life, that Ted Braden was D.B. Cooper. And that came from a guy named Leonard Tilley that knew Ted Braden in Vietnam and did not like him personally at all. He said he made him nervous. Said he would do all those things, that he was that confident that he was Cooper.
Was Braden the type of person that would brag, or was he not? I mean, I guess if he was D.B. Cooper, then he never really bragged about it, except maybe to his few slick.
Bragged. He's the type that could keep a secret.
Right.
Al Tyer, who knew him well when he was his teammate on the Golden Arrows. Braden was married three times. His last wife was Pauline. His second wife was, her name was Patricia Blizzard Braden. And Al Tyer had lived with them in Germany for a while when they were stationed in Germany in the early 1960s, before Braden went to Vietnam in 65. He knew Ted really well, close friend, knew his second wife very well. And Al did not know that Braden had two biological children. And when he found that out, that I found it out, his mind was blown. He's like, I'm stunned that he would never tell me that. Like, even if he was estranged or did not give them any, child support or whatever it was called back in the day, he was stunned, as well as he knew him, that he never confided in him that he had two biological children, which is a fact that he did. Yeah. And he never told anyone in Vietnam that. No one knew it. Back to his stepdaughter, the only reason that I really got her attention is when I, because he's obviously not her favorite subject, but that I told her, I said, did you realize he had two biological children? And she said, really? Like, she couldn't believe it.
She had no idea. Yeah.
She had zero idea. Her mother had no idea. No one had any clue. Of course, he was very estranged from them. I've tried to get a hold of both of them, and I've had zero luck. He's got a grandson who's an attorney in Chicago. Will not talk. I have my friend Ryan, I mentioned, he's an attorney in Mississippi, and usually an attorney will give a little bit of listen to another attorney, just as a kind of a courtesy as people that are attorneys. And he would not respond to Ryan. We know who he is. We know where he lives. We know his email address and his phone number. He isn't talking. I don't know how much he might know or not, but we just said, it's like, hey, we just want to share what we have. And He's not interested in talking whatsoever, which is just kind of adds to the mystery, I guess.
One last question about this is one of the things that I've heard, one of the arguments I've heard for D.B. Cooper died in the jump is that if the money had been spent, it would have been tracked by the FBI, because they wouldn't have had the serial numbers. And that's how they knew that that $5,800 was from the Cooper jump.
Yeah, they did. It did. It had serial numbers that were recorded. They were, it had all been written down, typed.
Yeah.
Like I did say, yes, not a number, another $20 bill has ever shown up in circulation.
Right.
But back then, you didn't have the internet. You know, you couldn't just look them up at a casino. And there was different ways of laundering that money. There was a global money exchange that went on that people knew about, especially that had been in Vietnam, where you could have easily taken it to a foreign country and filtered it out. It's definitely possible that money got a swap for something else in another country that just never made its way back, you know, to somebody that would have actually bothered to try to match it up. Of course, the serial numbers were available, but you didn't have the internet where you could just pull up the whole list of the bills.
Right.
One thing I know that Ryan's working on is looking for what's called star notes, which I think are collectible, like a $20 bill that you would keep because it was more collectible because it had the star on it, which I don't know if it was like one out of every 20 bills, but some of the Cooper bills would have been star notes. So he's trying to go find people that might own these star notes from. I think mostly the Cooper money was at 1969 Mark $20 bills, so they're looking for it that way. So if one of those ever did turn up, I think it would be a great proof that he did survive. But no, one's never shown up, and that could be made for an argument. But they never found the body. They never found the parachute. You know, it was very survivable. Of course, the water, if you fell in the water, it's very cold. You probably would have died. But the water to the ratio where we think he jumped was maybe 10%. So he would have just been very unlucky if he hit the water and was able to get, not able to get out. But most people in the vortex lean towards survival because it was very survivable. It wasn't an easy jump, but a guy like Braden could have done it with blindfolded.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about the Cooper case is you could make a good argument that he wasn't an experienced jumper. You could make an argument that he was, and you could make a solid argument that he wasn't. That's just how this case is, unfortunately. People would say, you know, why would an experienced parachutist not bring their own parachute on? It's a good question because a lot of them would have only trusted their own gear. A guy like Braden, who was really not afraid of death, probably would have figured that since he's getting four parachutes total. And of course, that was smart because they were thinking he's going to take a hostage with him. One of the parachutes was famously a reserve that was sewn shut for training by a guy named Earl Cossey, which is really interesting when you get into stuff like conspiracies with D.B. Cooper, because Earl Cossey who claimed to supply the parachutes, and it was kind of in dispute with another guy named Norman Hayden. But we do know that Earl Cossey packed at least two of the parachutes. It came out, at one point saying how survivable the jump was. And then all of a sudden he changes his tune and says, no, I think D.B. Cooper died. And he was the go-to guy for the FBI for years on the Cooper case. And he kind of got outed in a book called Skyjack by a guy named Jeffrey Gray, which is still the best-selling D.B. Cooper book about how he flip-flopped and didn't, you know, it really hurt his credibility when that book came out. And then later Earl Cossey's murdered at his home in Washington. He's murdered in his driveway. Nothing was stolen from his house. His wallet was taken. And then weeks later, the contents from his wallet are mailed back to his son and daughter with no note. You know, somebody found the contents of the wallet and didn't say where they found it. Anything that may have, you know, tried to lead to Earl's killer. So that's another, you know, just one of those big Cooper conspiracy type deals is, what did Cossey know and why was he murdered? Because to this day, they have not caught the person that killed Earl Cossey, who was definitely involved in this case and did pack the parachutes.
Yeah, so that might lend to the fact that there could be some collaboration or something, you know, some
yeah, kind or of he knew accomplices. Something, or he knew something, yeah. And they were afraid of what right. he knew. I mean, you know, a lot of people, oh, why? No one died. It wasn't that important, but you never know. I mean, maybe they did not want it, whatever he might have known getting out, and that's, you know, it could have been just a failed robbery that killed this guy. But it's strange, you know, the only thing that was taken was his wallet, and the strange thing about it was the contents were mailed back, and no one ever, they didn't say where they found it, it didn't have a name, no return address. They were just simply mailed back to his children with no clue. Like, I mean, that might have been a good lead for investigators. Oh, I found this wallet behind a dumpster over on M Street, you know, and then they could go asking questions around there, but they didn't. And they put out a reward for the person to come forward with full anonymity to say, please just tell us where you found the wallet. No one ever came forward.
Well, Drew, this has been fascinating. I mean, this has been a fascinating interview, and I feel like we've just kind of scratched the surface on just how deep and complex this case is. I think what we'll do as far as like the Zodiac Killer stuff, I'd love to have you come back on and talk about that.
Yeah, definitely.
Sometime. Yeah, that's yet another rabbit hole.
Big rabbit hole.
For sure. So we'll probably schedule that up at a certain point, you know, sometime coming up in the new year. But Drew, can you tell people where they can find your books and sure. all that good stuff?
Yeah, it's all on Amazon. I have a website, it's drewbeesonbooks.com. I have a YouTube channel called Drew Beeson, True Crime and Missing People on YouTube. And that's a good way to find me. And then a lot of this material is on there for free. If you're not a big reader, like I'm not a big reader. So you can find a lot of this stuff on YouTube, Zodiac stuff, Ted Braden, and of course, Yuba County 5 that we talked about, and some other things as well.
All right. Yeah. And you were the first guest on the reboot of Banal of America.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
I highly recommend that interview, guys, if you want to find more about the Yuba County 5 and some of the work Drew has done on that. So it's been very, very, very interesting stuff. Stay on the line for me. I'm just going to close this show out. But guys, I want to thank you guys for listening to the show. We are rapidly approaching the end of the year. And as always, we have Dr. Future coming out to end the year with us. And that will be the next episode. And hopefully Sergio will be back with us as well. But we will catch you on the next episode of Conspiranormal.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.